So hi everybody, I'm Vaughn. I work in the DX team at Microsoft and as the app ecosystem lead, and our job is to ensure developer success. And as some of you may have seen me this morning, I was talking about how we work with a lot of developers and we see what people are doing. And one of the areas that I'm heavily involved in is Windows Phone 8.1. And Windows Phone 8.1, when it came out, had just hundreds of features, and there were some headline features and some really good, features that sort of, when you talk about them, sound great, but there were also a lot of features that on the platform can really achieve a lot more than what at first sight people think, or we're seeing a lot of interesting implementations of it which have really good business use cases or really good opportunities for people building apps. And so I'm just going to go through a few of them here. So in this session, I'm going to talk about geofencing, universal apps for a bit. I know you just sort of had a session on that if you were in here before. I'm going to talk about HTML apps and really where the power is in HTML apps on Windows Phone. I'm going to talk about the web authentication broker and the credential locker, which may sound really dry, but they are excellent and they add a lot of value to your apps. I'm going to talk a bit briefly about background tasks and triggers and just the new tasks and triggers and what they mean. And I'll talk about Cortana and just adding Cortana to your apps and just how easy that is. The main thing I want you to get out of this session is probably a place where you might want to ask a lot of questions. I know you've been in a lot of sessions today that may have deep dived on some of this stuff as well. But also, if you've got any questions along the way, but especially at the end, feel free to have me. And if there's nothing that there's things that I haven't covered, feel free to also ask questions about that. And if not during this session, tomorrow, whenever, come and grab me, because there's a lot to talk about and we've only got 45 minutes. Plus, I'm very aware there's drinks after this, so I won't keep you. So there's a lot more to talk about. There's probably about 5 slides that look like this of key features that are new to the platform that can change the way that you build apps. One of the things I wanted to cover in this was Bluetooth as well as NFC. There just isn't enough time. So if you've got any questions about that stuff, please come and grab me afterwards. So the slide before had like an order of things I was going to go through, and I changed it at the last minute. So we're going to go through things in a bit different order. So I'm going to talk about background tasks and triggers. So Windows Phone brought a heap of new background tasks and triggers, and I'm going to go through some of them. Now, this is sort of just some of the documentation, but I'm going to go into detail around a couple of the new ones which are really important. And the main one is the time trigger. So the reason why the time trigger is important is because it's really good if you want to kick things off when somebody installs your application for the first time. So because it's a time trigger, they don't have to open your application to kick this off, which means that if you're doing things, I'll talk about geofencing in a second, but geofencing is one of the implementations that can really leverage this. But you also might want to know how many times your application has been installed. So you know how many people have downloaded your application from the store, as in how many people have actually bought your application or purchased your application, but how many times has it actually been installed? And that may change if they've got multiple devices. You want to know that they've installed it across multiple devices. And you can start tracking in your analytics when they first installed the application, that they've installed the application. They also may never have opened it. So it also gives you an idea of how many times a certain version's installed, but it's never been opened. Things like that. The location triggers are based on geofencing, so I won't go into that because I'm going to talk about it a bit later. Push notification triggers, so running and triggering background tasks off push notifications. The Bluetooth triggers, so doing things when you've got things nearby with Bluetooth, when the connections are being created and pulled down, and when the strength diminishes as well with the Bluetooth signal strength trigger. There's a lot of new triggers in Windows Phone 8.1 that were not there before. And so they can change the application, you can do a lot more with it. I'm not going to go into detail on too much on how to implement them here because they're all different and it would just take forever and it'd be quite dry. But it's definitely worth looking at because you will find that there's new ways that you can make your applications a bit smarter and interact with users a bit better. So some of the things you can also do with the triggers when you set them up is the conditions around when they occur. So you may have a trigger that you want to trigger a background event to occur, but it needs to go and talk to the internet. But if there is no internet, then there's no point triggering your application. So you can set up triggers to say, well, if the internet's not available, I don't want to trigger the trigger. Or if there's a free network capacity available, If the user is using the phone or not using the phone, do you want to run that background task or not? Maybe you're going to put a notification up on the screen. If they're using the phone, you might not want to do that. But maybe there's what you want to do is put a notification up on the phone to get them back into the phone. So you might have use cases when you want to do that. As you can see there, you know, it's very easy to add conditions. You can add conditions, multiple conditions. You don't just have to have one conditions, and you can just go through. You see here you've got a task builder, and then you just go and add the conditions that you need there. As I said, I'm not going to go into too much detail on triggers because they're pretty dry. So HTML and JavaScript applications. So JavaScript and HTML, or what we used to refer to as WinJS applications, became first class citizens on Windows Phone 8.1. And so one of the things that's interesting here is that now you're not building an embedded browser app within, it's not an embedded browser within your application. JavaScript is running from the core, and so therefore you have access to all the functionality on the platform that you would have, say, from a .NET application. But one of the things, one of the really powerful things that comes with this is the tooling and just how easy the tooling is to use and how powerful it is. So not only are you using the IE11 engine to run your applications, but you can start doing some really interesting stuff when you want to look at the DOM and understand where in the DOM you're looking at and where in the file, the HTML DOM that you're at, and what sort of DOM is being constructed. But the other thing is, and one of the things that I found incredible, is the JavaScript profiling. And so because you can debug and profile HTML and JavaScript so well, it actually makes Windows Phone an amazing platform. If you're thinking about doing cross-platform HTML and JavaScript development, Windows Phone becomes this really sort of attractive place to start developing those applications. So you might be putting them on iOS and Android or anything else, but on Windows Phone, the tooling for HTML-based apps becomes incredibly powerful. So what I'm going to do is just quickly just show you some of the profiling tools around it. So, cool. If you've got an issue seeing any of this, just yell out. This one. So great, it's the application that's actually currently running. So one of the things that you can do, obviously you can run the application, but if we go up here to analyze, you've got performance and diagnostics. And if I get rid of that, you should be able to maybe read that. So what you can do here is you can come in here and you can select what sort of performance analysis you want to do, and you can do some together. So you could do CPU and energy consumption, so you could see how much battery it's using, and that would be interesting from nearly any application's perspective, but from a HTML and JavaScript perspective, you can start to do JavaScript memory and JavaScript function timing. So if I go into JavaScript memory and just hit start, and it's gonna boot up effectively a nothing application. And this is just the demo, that's sort of the demo hub application that I've created, so it's just a default application. I haven't done anything special to add the profiling, but what we can see here is the memory usage as we use the app. And so if I go in here and browse to a part of the application where there's absolutely nothing, you'll see that as I browsed, the memory went up. If I go back, scroll across again, click on something else, the memory will probably do a little leap. No, it's not enough text. I'll see if I can find something else. And it's just slowly going up as I'm adding just little bits of stuff to the memory. But when you've got an application that's really complex, it's pulling in images and it's loading a heap of stuff, you take a snapshot, for example, and then what you can do is you can go through and there's 4,383 objects and just see what's chewing up your memory. So you can do this amazing JavaScript memory profiling on the objects that are sitting in there. And if we go through and look at the strings, you'll notice that some of them are images, some of them are just the titles. And so you can see where your data and where your memory is being consumed in this meaningful way, which you can then sort of track down bugs and why there's all these things happening. So that's one of the profilers. But if I get rid of that diagnostic session and go up to performance analysis, scroll down. So with the JavaScript memory analysis, you can't do that alongside anything else. So if I check that off and do the function timing, So I might be doing with the function timing, what I might want to do is actually pause the application. So when it starts, I don't want to just start capturing all the data because I want to get to a specific point in time and then capture the data while I'm interacting just to see where my performance overheads are. So if I click start, it'll kick off, close the app, reopening the app, and it kicks off and what I'm going to do is just go back here and stop collecting straight away. Because I might find that at the beginning of my application, there might be an animation or something that I'm doing, but it's really chunky and it's doing something weird. Obviously, some CPU contention. And so what this is doing is going through all the function call data that it collected. And you'll notice that when I come in here, it'll say, okay, here's the hot path. I can see that 60% of my CPU time was chewed up in a call to the date now function. And that's been called from a function called the sum function. Didn't really think that one through when I said it. But what I can see here is that all those date now calls, all of them, and you can see here, this is just burning CPU. All of them came from the sum function. They weren't from anywhere else. 60% of that CPU time was chewed up by that. And so if I click on there on the sum function, I'll just close this. It'll show me that the global code, somewhere in the global code, called the sum function, which then did all those calls to the date function now. And then when I come into the code, and because I've come in sort of a bit big, you'll see that in my JavaScript in the DOM of just the first page that it loads, I've written some code to just chew up a heap of CPU. But in your applications, you'll be able to see that actually the date now function, it's actually working well. In some places, it's kind of called a couple of times. It's using 0.5% of the CPU or 0.1%. But there's somewhere in my code where I'm calling it in a loop rather than calling it before the loop because that's good enough to use inside the loop. So there's different ways with which you can profile your code. It's what we've had in the browser for a while. It's what we've had in Visual Studio for WinJS apps on desktop. And it's very powerful if you're doing high processing in JavaScript or games especially. So if you're doing a lot of HTML-based games or if you're doing animations, you can actually see where in your JavaScript this is being chewed up. And you can sort of follow the function graph through here because we go back to the global code, but the global code only calls one thing anyway, so it's not that detailed. So I'll just jump back. Universal apps. So universal apps are... So one of the things that was sort of announced recently was Windows 10, and a few people have been asking me already, you know, what's the go for Windows 10 app development? And the message still is, keep building universal apps. So don't change what you're doing, keep building universal apps. And you know, when universal apps turned up with Windows Phone 8.1, we got a few things, and I guess the concept was one project to rule them all. So one project for Windows Phone and Windows 8 projects. And as you've probably seen in some of the other sessions today, the ability to add different types of projects under that. So we've seen people that have Xamarin projects with Windows Phone, Windows 8, as a universal project with shared code, and then they've gone and added iOS, Android, and a heap of other platforms that they're building on top of within that project. And so universal projects are a way, it's not just for Windows Phone and for Windows 8, and from Visual Studio, when you just go create new project, that's what you get. But you can start pulling in other template projects into that. So you can start sharing code across all those C# projects and those .NET projects. We call it one project to rule them all, but it's not just one project. It's a structure that is aware of each other of multiple projects. So you have your shared projects, you have your Windows 8 project, you have a Windows Phone project. They're still projects by themselves. And when you build, it's not building one binary, it's still building a separate binary for each platform. But what you're doing is having one code base to spit out those different binaries. The main reason for this, and the reason that it's in Visual Studio and it's not just a best practice, is to make sure that everyone has a common approach for sharing logic, resources, source code. We wanted a way to have for you to be able to share XAML and UI widgets, not just logic. Because you could share logic in a PCL before, but what we wanted to be able to do is share some really core resources and things like that between projects in a familiar way that wasn't 20 minutes to go set it up so I got it right. If you just wanted to experiment and have something running on two things or spit something out quickly, you could just go and create it. And as I said before, it expands beyond that. So I'm just going to go in and talk about it briefly. Was anyone at the Universal App session? Can I see some hands? Okay, I'll be really quick then, because it was most of you. So in here, as you can see on that right-hand side, I'll just expand it. We do have the Universal app, and you can see you've got a Windows app, 8.1 app, and Windows Phone 8.1 app, and this shared app. And this shared app is where you're going to be writing most of your code. If it's not UI, it should be in here. If it's integration with services, it should be in here. It's not just some logic that sits on your phone, sits on the phone. It could be something that's talking to something server side. You chuck it all in the shared project. What you really want to do is only have UI interaction and platform specific code within those Windows 8 and Windows Phone 8.1 projects. And so examples of some of the platform specific code might be, for example, I know that Windows 8.1 has some very specific stuff you want to talk to Xbox services, and Windows Phone does it in a different way. So if you're going to do that, you would have that code sitting within those projects. And a great way to approach that is to wrap them in an abstract class or in a facade within that shared project. So everything's still talking in a way to some shared code, and the shared code, if you use, especially if you're using partial classes, you can actually then go and fill them out in the other projects. And what that allows you to do is have a common interface, a common set of code. Nothing really needs to know what it's talking to. You might have some common logic that wants to go and talk to a platform-specific service, but even it doesn't need to know about it. And you start to abstract your code that way. But aside from that, I'm not going to go into too much detail just because everyone saw it before. But if you do want to create one, just for those of you who weren't here before, it's just a matter of going File, New Project. And if you pick a Visual C Sharp project, you actually get Universal Apps, which will be a Windows Phone project and a Windows 8 projects all in one, set up as a universal app with a shared project. You don't have to do anything else. Okay, I'll go back to slides. We just looked at that. The next one, geofencing. So geofencing is something that I am seeing more and more that people are using it and more that people are interested in it. So when it first came out, people went, oh, that's cool, you know, you can trigger things for when you're near somewhere. And for those that don't know, I should probably go into it, is geofencing is when you have a location or an area and you have these fences, these geographical fences, these geolocations, which are a point and a radius, so they're always a circle. And when you want to trigger an event when something enters or leaves that radius. Now, they're not symmetrical. When you enter, it's the size that you want it to be, and when you leave, it's a little bit bigger. Otherwise, if you're standing on the edge, sort of doing this, or if your location's just shifting slightly, it'll trigger again and again, and you don't want that. So it's set up in a way that when you leave, it sort of makes it so that if you've entered, you can't just sort of take a step and all of a sudden leave again. And they can be of any size, so they can be as big as you want. You general guidance is you probably at most want to have 1,000 within your application. You shouldn't really have that because there's ways to solve that problem. I'm not going to go into it too much. The app will probably stop working at about 20,000. But you should probably only really have about 50 to 100. You don't need that many. And I'll talk about why in a second. So the way that geofences work is they actually sit in a database on the phone as part of the core logic of all the location services. And so when an event happens within the geofences, it will trigger the related background task or activity within the application. So they can be both in foreground and background. So if you've got common logic that's handling this, and it will differ based, your activity will differ based on where it's in the background and foreground, you'll need to check the execution. But aside from that, there's not too much you need to worry about. It's just in the background class, you don't want to kick off any long running stuff. That's probably not the way to do it. And then in the foreground, you probably might want to leave some stuff for the background task later because it's not important. So the question becomes, why geofencing? Why do people want to use geofencing? So one of the things that comes up a lot is to start actions based on location. So proposals, reminders, collecting some data and doing things automatically. And the other thing is not just doing them automatically, but doing things on behalf of the user automatically. Things that they would usually do is to say, I've turned up to this location, collect some data. Or I've turned up to this location, I need to log that I've been to this location. Now, the reason you don't want to do this with just a location tracking task in the background like you could in Silverlight apps is because that used to chew a lot of battery. Whereas this is running in a much more efficient manner, and it's running across all the applications, so you don't have multiple background tasks kicking off and all trying to get app location at the same time. This is the phone aware of your location and therefore understanding which triggers need to be triggered and calling your application. So it's a lot more efficient. And the other thing that you can do is sort of trigger something when I arrive, trigger something when I leave, and of course the other thing you can do is the background task can have a background task kick off periodically to check whether they've left, so therefore you know that they're still there. So you can do some sticky stuff. So if you're in a shopping mall for a long time, you might be looking for food. But if you just walked in, yeah, you might not be. So the use cases that we're starting to see are field workers on the road, people that need to go and repair equipment, people that might pick up jobs to do stuff, but instead of them picking up jobs, they may be driving from A to B. It's not an area that they usually service. And as they're driving through, they may enter a service area where they could actually go and fix something. Or there might be, is anybody nearby? Because this isn't a priority, but if you're nearby, can you go and fix it? And it might be something that over time escalates, but if you just happen to be in the location, it might be efficient to do. Offers is a big one, obviously. Alerts and notifications, hi. Just letting you know you're in this area and there's currently a security warning, for example, or a safety warning. Customization of applications based on critical locations. So you may actually change or pull through different data because somebody's in a different location. They may be in a different shopping center or in a different town, a different suburb. So you might want to pull up if you're a real estate application, rather than going and saying, hey, where are you, and pulling down the data, you might actually want to go and grab that data from the background task. And then there's been some really interesting stuff that some of the people that came to some of the training that we've been doing over the last year, one of the guys developed an application so that when he leaves his house, his lights turn off. So he's connected up his lights, and these Internet of Things and these connected house scenarios. If he walks out with his phone, the lights turn off. And then he realized that there were scenarios where his partner didn't enjoy the fact that he walked out and the lights turned off. So then he had to go and put the app on her phone, and then therefore now they both have to have left the house for the lights to go off. The other scenario is you can start getting quite complex with is if I leave work, because it knows where you work, after 5 p.m. on a Friday during winter, turn on the heater because I'm going to come home and I'm going to sit on the couch. So that sounds like a really complex scenario, but if you've got a power board or a switch that can be connected to the Internet of Things or connected to the cloud, all of a sudden, to write an app to go and do that on your phone, it's only probably about 10 lines of code. It's really easy to do. So I've got a demo of an app that sort of shows some of the geofences. I'm not going to go through the app because it's about running around to different locations. I can't do that in this room, but I'll bring it up now. So we're up there. Let's close this off. And routing fencing. So set as a startup and run it in the emulator. So I should say that all of the demo apps that I'm using today, they're all actually in the Windows Phone 8.1 Jumpstart on MVA. And so if you go to Microsoft Virtual Academy, you'll actually be able to see videos that deep dive on all the specifics that I'm showing you. But also, you'll also be able to grab the source code, because the source code is available for all of these as well. And so this comes from one that actually does a routing demo. So if I click on that, I should get the routing. There we go. And if I just squeeze out, so this is a demo that's looking at mapping and routing and how to get routing information. And it draws the routing information on the map. But the other thing that it'll do, it'll draw the geofences. And what this application does is that it's about triggering and letting you know when you need to turn right, when you need to turn right again, and then turn right again, then turn left. And so it's actually using geofences to give you a routing demo. And you probably wouldn't use it specifically just for routing, but this is just a demo of where those geofences sit in the app. And you'll see here that there's around about, I know, as many geofences as needed. And so one of the questions that last study was asked was around, can you programmatically create geofences? And yes, you can. You can preload the app with geofences, but you can also programmatically create them. So based on the route, you can then go and create a geofence. So if we were to change this route, we could then end up with different geofences, and therefore we could do that. So for different people, you might have totally customized, algorithmically based geofences. And so that application's there. So if I just go into the app and just to look at some of the source code, whoa, that's really big font. And there's a method in here, which is, actually no, it's not in there, because all the shared code goes into the shared, where is it? Oh, here we go. So what happens is, in the code, obviously, it does the routing, and it gets the routing, and it gets all the different points where you need to turn. And then what it does is it comes in here, and it goes and it adds all the geofences. But before it does that, and I'm trying to get all of this on screen so we can see it. What it does is it goes to the geofence monitor, gets the current geofence monitor, which is just the one that exists, but it gets the instance of it, gets all the geofences, and looks for the geofences that possibly, if the one exists with that key, and makes sure it's removed, so we don't sort of try and add one with the same key at the same location, because you don't want to have multiple geofences at the same location. You don't want multiple geofences at the same location for this purpose, so because then they'd just be overlapping and exactly the same. But you may have different size ones for whatever reason for your own purposes. So it creates the geo circle, and then what it does is, what it wants to do is it wants to know when you've entered and exited. So the application will get a notification when you've entered and exited it. You might not care if they've exited. Sometimes you just don't care. Sometimes you don't care if they've entered. You only care if they've exited. So there's no point getting the phone to trigger your background task. The other thing that you can do is you can also track whether it's been removed. So if a geofence gets removed, or a user actually specifically goes and says, I want to remove that, the application might want to do something smart when it gets removed. And then all it does is it creates the new geofence with the key, the location. I'll talk about some of the other properties of a geofence in a second. And then it just goes and adds it. And then when it's added it, the background task will get triggered when you enter the geofence or exit the geofence. So it's pretty straightforward. And if we go down here, you'll see the geofence state changed event, where right there in the middle of the screen, when it's entered and when it's exited, do something. You know, here it's displaying maneuver and hiding maneuver, so it's showing you whether you need to turn right or turn left and things like that. But let's not worry about what it's doing there. For your purposes, you can get it to do anything during that block of code, within reason. So, I'm going to pop back. How are we going for time? Okay, plenty of time. So, they have to be circles. So at the moment, there's no other geometry type. There is a property of a geofence called geometry type, of which there's currently one. So hopefully, one day, there might be more, but there's ways to sort of break down your geofences to be smaller geofences, which have a particular shape. It'd be great to be able to abstract that from people, though. So, you know, if you feel like writing that library, let me know. Okay, so for those that didn't know, the question was, can geofences be anything but a circle? They have to be a point and a radius at the moment. So geofences, so let's just talk about some of the events. So we've got entered, exited, and removed. There's not a stay. The stay is you running a background task and realizing they haven't exited, okay? Or you may want to check the location, but you could probably trust the geofencing as well. But some of the other properties, single use, you probably don't care for a routing application that they've entered and exited a point. If it was, for example, a race and you had to go from A to B and you didn't care if they came back, that was them lost. You care about sending them A to B. But you have a single-use geofence, or have you finally arrived? You've arrived, great, let's get rid of it. So you don't have to then go and remove that yourself. If it's single-use, it will only trigger once. Dwell time, so how long until it triggers? So if somebody enters an area and you want to know that they've been there for a period of time rather than they've just turned up there because your use case may change, especially in shopping centers, for example, you know, hey, you might be interested in food, you've been in the shopping center for half an hour. So dwell time is a great way to sort of, for you not to have to always check. Start time, so what did they enter? That should be when did they enter. So if somebody enters a geofence, it's not guaranteed that the background trigger will happen immediately. They can only happen every 2 minutes. So if someone's going from geofence to geofence to geofence, going at a million miles an hour, the issue that you run into is that you don't want it to be triggering background tasks non-stop. The battery would just go flat in 2 seconds. And so what you want to do is trigger it every 2 minutes. So therefore, it could be a minute 59 old, the data, because they might have gone straight from one to another at the same time. The other reason is that there may be a scenario where there is contention on the background task. There may be background tasks currently running and you're waiting for them to finish before the geofence triggers. And in that scenario, the start time may be 10 seconds, for 15 seconds, 5 seconds prior. And so if you're doing things that maybe you don't care if it's 2 minute old data, or if you're doing things where the time is important, you want to record the time of when that event happened, you make sure that you check the start time. And the duration. How long they've been in the geofence. So we'll give you the time since the start time, which you can figure out yourself. So geofences in background tasks, this is probably more important than doing it in your app. In your app, you sort of can not really care and not be as efficient as you want to be or should be. But in background tasks, you have to be. Otherwise, the execution may end. It may be killed. So execution is throttled by 2 minutes. As I said before, it can't happen any more than once every 2 minutes. So keep your geofences at a reasonable size. The recommended size is no smaller than 50 meter radius. The accuracy, you're probably going to find that you might trigger stuff at a smaller radius anyway, because the GPS might think you're down the street or up the street. So if you had a 2 meter radius out the front of a store, it's probably going to have you in front of the store down the road or anywhere else, just because of the way that GPS works. So you want to keep them at a reasonable size. Coarse grain gives better results. If you think about your problem and solving your problem at a broader level, rather than at a coarse grain saying, hi, you're outside my store, come in for a special, that's probably not going to work. Where it might say, if you had something that was larger saying, hi, you're nearby, I was wondering if you wanted to come down, we're running some sales at the moment. If they've got your app installed, they're highly likely to be engaged with that and interested in that. As I said, check the time. I gave you all the reasons before, so I'm not going to go into that now. And geofence events can happen in the background and the foreground. I've mentioned that before. Just make sure that you're just checking. So you may want to do different things in the foreground. Obviously, if your app's running, you might want to do some stuff that's visual. But the other thing is you might not be doing visual things. However, bear in mind, you may be talking over the network for an extended period of time or doing some CPU intensive tasks. And you might not want to do that in the background task, but only in the foreground task. And as examples of where you might do it, collect in the background and do the processing in the foreground, is you might capture the event in the background, but when the app is open, that might be when you start doing some of the processing on that data. So we're talking about, you know, creating geofences programmatically, probably never having more than 1,000, crashing your app if you've got 20,000. Actually, I think it starts to really play up with the phone, because the phone's got to check, we've got to be checking that list of 20,000 every time it checks in the background. So it starts to create some big issues. But let's say that your application, these are the areas that you're interested in. And the one over New South Wales is pretty broad, but you know, the one in Western Australia and the Northern Territory, they're still quite large. You know, you don't want to just trigger to say, hey, you're in New South Wales, maybe you do, but you know, how can you make that useful? And so what the strategy that we're seeing a lot of people implement, which works really well, is, you know, divvying things up into zones and then having a collection of geofences sitting under that zone. So when you enter one zone, and so let's say you entered New South Wales, all of a sudden you can go, well, the zones that I care about are these zones. And so then you go and create those geofences. So off the base of entering one geofence, you go and create more geofences. And then you go, okay, they've entered that zone. So therefore, what I'm going to do is I'm going to divvy up that geofence. And so as you move through the geofences, you're creating more coarse grain. And what you can do is just get rid of all the others. But then as they exit geofences, you can start go from more fine grain to more coarse grain, so you can make them larger again. You may also want to keep those really high level ones. So whenever you've entered a geofence, you can say, hey, just for some reason just saw you re-enter that big geofence, because maybe you're on the border between where that small circle touches the side of the big circle, and it can go, oh no, it's okay, because you know I already am at that coarse grain level, I don't have to go any further. I've already got something that's a child zone of the parent zone. So I'm not going to go talk about too much more on geofencing, but if you've got any other questions and ideas or things you want to see if possible, come and grab me after. The credential locker. So the credential locker just sounds like this really boring thing, but there's a reason why it's important. And when universal apps arrived, and as people start to get multiple devices, the credential locker, especially on desktop, PC, laptop, and on their phone, and tablets, you want a place to store their credentials. You've got a universal app that can share data, but you also want a secure way to share their passwords. Because you don't want to just store it in plain text in the shared data area, because then it can be in a way that, let's say that you had a virus or something like that, you could go and grab that data and it's not necessarily secure. You don't want to store it in plain text. And maybe you don't know how to store it securely. Or maybe the way to store it securely changes over time and you just don't want to worry about it. And you shouldn't worry about it. You should just use the credential locker. So the credential locker is just APIs to store your username and passwords. The namespace is Windows Security Credentials. It's pretty straightforward. It's really easy to use. It's secure storage, so it's all encrypted. You don't have to worry about encrypting it yourself. The credentials are isolated, so you're guaranteed that other applications aren't going to be able to get access to those credentials. But it's the one of the things that's really interesting is it's roaming. And so now with universal applications, you can put stuff in roaming data, which is very easy. It's just like, if you're going to put stuff in roaming data, it just roams onto all the other machines. But one of the things is if you put credentials in the roaming data, that will also propagate to your other machines. And so it'll go from your phone, if you've got the same application installed on your Windows 8.1 machine, that credential will go across. So the application on the Windows 8.1 machine can actually go, do I have credentials? Yes, and it can automatically log you in. So one of the things to be really clear is that apps can only access their own credentials. And so an app can talk to the credential locker and get credentials in and out. And another app can put credentials in and out of the credential locker. So it's sitting in this location that only that user and apps of that user can get access to. But the apps cannot see the other app's credentials. But as I said before, you're in this scenario where credentials can roam between trusted devices. So if you've got these two machines that you log in with your Microsoft account and you can share roaming data between them, the credential data can also be shared between them. So your applications get access to the credential data between your Windows 8 application and your Windows Phone 8.1 application. And so I'm not going to show a demo in the code because, again, it's pretty dry, but it's pretty straightforward. So when you want to save it, you create the password vault, you create a credential, and you add it. It's that easy. And when you want to retrieve the credential, you create the password vault, and then you grab it. So you've got a string with which you want to pull it out, and here you've got my app resource, so you'll have a key that you may want to store it. You may want to store it different bits for different parts of your app. You might have multiple credentials, maybe not, but it's very simple. It's just a matter of storing and retrieving it. Done. Now your application on your Windows 8 machine can now use the same credentials and you haven't had to write any other code. It's just there for you. Okay. And yeah, next thing. I'm going to talk about this quickly because they're sort of related. The next one is the Web Authentication Broker. So this is something that turned up in Windows 8. It was there at the beginning in Windows 8. And it's a unified way to do OAuth, and it creates a unified experience. And so when we talk about OAuth, we're talking about authenticating users against services like Twitter and Facebook and Gmail and your Google account and your Microsoft account. And so you have this online service and then you have your phone, and what happens is it sends a request across, and then what you do is you open up a browser control at the moment, like this is the scenario, and then what you do is they log in through the browser control and they enter their credentials, and so the user does that, and then it sends back down, and then you get back the user decision on whether they want to accept or not accept this thing, and then a token gets passed back to the app. But the other thing that happens is sometimes you have to say, hey, here's a code, and put that code in your app, and you see all these apps doing it in different ways, and it becomes overly complex, and from a user perspective, sometimes it feels a bit clunky, and you're not really sure you want to give this thing in this app your details, because it's a bit different to the other one, and do you trust it or not? And so what happens is, at the end of all of that, you do get access to the service, but it's not whether it's trusted or not. So what the web authentication broker does is it creates this way that's unified between all the applications and a common experience for people to do OAuth. Now, OAuth doesn't have to be just these services. It could be any OAuth service. You may even have your own. And because it's a unified, not just a unified way to implement, but a unified user experience, it's going to become more often and more likely the trusted way for people to enter credentials. So if your app isn't using it for OAuth, over time, as everyone else starts using it or is using it, your application is going to probably fall into the less trusted bucket of applications. It's got nothing to do with you, but people are giving you their username and password. And so there's the namespace. And as I said before, it supports things like single sign-on. It's a very simple API to use. It simplifies and it hides a lot of the processing of the pages and the monitoring of where the pages are. When you bring up that embedded web browser control. But it also has credential isolation, which means that your credentials are not going to the app and the user credentials aren't coming to you. If you're an app builder, the last thing you want to be dealing with is people's credentials for systems other than your own. You don't want to be dealing with their Twitter account. You don't want to be the person that lets that cat out of the bag. You want that to be someone else's problem. So make it Microsoft's problem. So in this scenario, what we do, the web authentication broker, is it sort of just isolates this whole process. So your application doesn't manage this process. It doesn't really know what's happening. It just happens. And you end up with a token at the end of it, or you end up with a reason why you don't get a token at the end of it. Now, it's a little bit different between Windows 8 and Windows Phone. In Windows Phone, your application can get terminated. So something to bear in mind. But when it goes back to your application, it will navigate back and it'll request back to the same page and it'll pass through the token. So it's the same experience whether your app gets terminated or not. It's just bear in mind that it may have been terminated. So if there's things that you may want to reinitialize or reinflate, just remember that you may need to do that. Here's some code. You can sort of see it there. Unactivated goes through, navigates to the page. But if I go down here we've got the continued web authentication, where it goes through, grabs the results, and it pulls the token off the argument. So that's the method that's getting triggered when it continues the process. So you need to just bear in mind that if the app's still open, this will trigger. If the app previously wasn't open, this needs to be triggered, and you can continue the process. So we'll go in here, and you can see here, I'll just bring this up. Now, the thing about this is that credentials may be pre-populated. So you're creating an amazing user experience. If somebody is using like their Twitter, their Google, their Microsoft, their Facebook account to sign into something as to identify themselves, and you're providing that, having your name, username, and password pre-populated is amazing, because you just go, yep, okay, cool, I'm signed up. And now you've got a user, and you can identify them, and it's been 3 clicks. It's incredible. The other thing you can do is you can say, please just save this password. So they may click on it and they may not see anything. They may just go straight across to the last piece, which is the consent. I give this person permission to see my Facebook profile photo and name and date of birth, or the usual consent. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to do a demo. I'll just kick this off. Bring this up, pin that. Web authentication demo. So startup project and run. So this is one of those demos that if you do it, it's really annoying to go back. Come on. It's a bit weird, I might just stop it. So the issue might with the demo might be that I actually authenticated before and it already has my credentials. Authenticate. Authenticate. Looks like the network's not playing nice. I'm gonna leave it there so I can just go on to the next bit. But what you would have seen is it would have just popped up with Twitter, you know, do you authenticate this user? My username and password would have been in there, and then I would have just gone, yep, log in. And then once I said log in, I would have then said, yes, I consent. Now, I hadn't clicked yes on that yet, just go through that, just log me in automatically next time and go straight to the consent piece. But the reason that my username and password were still there is because all of that sort of stuff is sitting in the system credential locker that I told it to sustain. So between applications, you end up in this scenario where you have a consistent experience where my username and password is pre-populated, I don't need to worry about it. Whereas if somebody puts a browser control, it feels a bit different because maybe it's not even the mobile version, maybe it's not even you know, pre-populated, but everything else is. So it's something to bear in mind that people aren't going to you know, want to go through. And it just looked very similar to the slide that I put up. So the reason I want to do that is I want to get to the next bit, which is last thing I want to talk about, and that's Cortana. So Cortana is this amazing service. If anyone's got it on their phone, you've probably used it. It's fantastic. But one of the things you can do with your applications is you can integrate Cortana into your applications. Now, Cortana in your applications is generally relates to speech recognition APIs, speech synthesis APIs, voice command definition files, and you can end up with Cortana integrated voice commands. Now, I'm not going to go in deep into the code. There's a really good demo. And it's a demo app that looks like this. And what's awesome about it is I'm pretty sure it's in the store. So if you go to the store, I think there is a voice search app, like MSDN voice search app in the store. And then when you go and view that on your Windows phone or even within the emulator, it'll actually tell you where to go and get the source code for it. So it's a bit weird when you launch the app and it asks you for your source code. So rather than talk about it much more, I'm going to talk about it, show you it. So I'm going to come across here. And in here, down the bottom, where are you? MSDN voice search. And so you'll notice here that there's a couple of voice command definition files. And so if you're thinking about programming some of this, there's two things to be aware of. Be very aware of the language speech setting on your phone, because if it doesn't line up with anything that's in this file, it won't trigger. Because this is only going to trigger for the languages that it's been set up for. And here it says ENUS. ENUS is a fallback for a lot of other English anyway. So if you might have Australian and UK as your language, but you may fall back into US anyway. So this will work on my phone, even though my phone is not set up for as ENUS. It's set up as a UK or maybe Australia from memory. And when you look at this file, and don't worry too much about it, especially if you can pull down this demo, there's a heap of stuff in this XML, but there's lots of really good examples of this. And what happens is it triggers commands, and those commands get triggered, and then you can do things like what this one does, which is search MSDN. And then what you're saying is, I want you to listen for search for, and dictate a heap of search terms, find a heap of search terms, and find here. And you'll notice up the top, or is it down the bottom? Yeah, it's here. when you want to actually search, you'll say, there's a here thing called dictated search terms, and then there's natural language search terms. But you'll say MSDN, and then you'll give it a heap of search terms. And so you say MSDN find this, or MSDN find that, or MSDN find, and then it'll launch the application. And that's all done through this file. And this file needs to sit alongside your application, because if it doesn't sit alongside your application, it won't get picked up. And so this means that you can talk to Cortana, and it's very similar to what we used to do in Windows Phone 8.1. It's just a little bit more advanced. But you can go into Cortana and say, hey, MSDN, find, and it will launch the application, at which you can do more. Now, this demo also goes a step further, where it actually adds the speech recognition capabilities in the application. I'm not going to go through that because that's sort of a bit more of a complex integration, but all the source code's there in this app. And if you want to know what you can do or what you can't do, let me know. There's some really great stuff if you're doing speech to text as well, to do things like you can get the text back, but it can also make sure that certain words don't come back. So you can have a kid's application and make sure that swear words don't end up in it and things like that, because it interpreted something the wrong way, or maybe the kid is swearing at it and wants the text back to be silly. But just be bear in mind that there's all this really powerful stuff in the speech engine as well, because natural language processing is very complex. And so I do have the application on my phone, and I don't have the projector screen, but hopefully you will, you're here. Here we go. Hang on. I just ended up with Cortana. So as you can see, maybe not, I'm at my start screen. Okay. MSDN find. Hang on, I'll do that again because I had it turned down. Go back. MSDN find.
Searching MSDN.
Could you hear that?
What would you like to search for?
Well, what would you like to search for? Cortana?
Searching for Cortana.
And so you can't really see it there, but what's happened there is that Cortana has gone and loaded the MSDN search, which the application does, with what I told her to, which was Cortana. So if I go across here, I'll just give you a quick overview of what that looks like in the app, because I can still, from memory, this is going to be a test as to whether my memory is any good or not. I'm pretty sure I have not run this in the emulator, because there was no microphone, So I'm pretty sure I didn't run it, but you may see it run. So that's what the app looks like. We saw it before. And when I said Cortana, it was the equivalent of me typing Cortana in here. And there you go. So that's what the application did, but it did it all on voice. And that's exactly what I see on my phone there. So you can go and add some really powerful stuff to your app. But you can also do things like go MSDN find Cortana, and it will launch the application. Your application can take that keyword after find and start searching for it. As well. So the other thing I'm going to do just quickly while we're here, and it looks like we've got internet working now, is I might just go back to the web authentication one and just see if I can get that working, because we've got about 5 minutes to wrap up. Okay, fingers crossed. Yeah, it doesn't want to behave. So I won't spend any time clicking on that button. Okay, so what we've covered. So in not this order, we covered geofencing, universal apps, HTML apps, and mainly the benefit of the tooling there. Not just the rendering engine, that's awesome. Having IE11 in your apps is amazing. But being able to profile apps that you might use elsewhere and get profiling that is just beyond anything else is just fantastic. The web authentication broker and the credential locker. So those two specifically are things that are just so easy to implement. They take so much work away from you, but they also mean that you're probably likely to implement more of those services to get identities, especially if you're not using the services. You just want to get an identity and you want a trusted identity. You'll start using more of those services because you're having to write less code anyway. We looked at background tasks and triggers just briefly. The main one, and probably the most important one, aside from the geofencing, of course, is the time trigger. Being able to do things when an application is first installed, which can include setting up all your geofences, because you want to have them set up. They may never open the application, but you want to start capturing the geofence data. And we also looked at speech and speech synthesis quickly with Cortana and just how quickly that is to set up. So if you've got any questions, just remember, there's a heap of other stuff that I haven't talked about. You know, it's a few days worth of discussion, but I am here today, I am here tomorrow. If you've got any questions, come and talk to me. And if you've got any now, feel free to come and ping me. Which means I also, thanks. I need to put this on, I think. Does anyone have the mic? Is there any? No? Okay, if you've got any questions, just come up and ask me and we'll sort of leave it for after the session. That's cool.